We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus 580 from Illinois Public Media. I'm Todd Gleason from University of Illinois Extension, sitting in for David Inge this morning. He is away this morning. In this first hour of Focus 580, we're going to talk about rural health care and access to rural health care. Paul McNamara is with us. He's with the Department of Agricultural Consumer and Economics in the Division of Nutritional Sciences in the Agricultural College here on the U of I campus. And we will be gladly taking your phone calls. I'll give you that number in just a few moments. But good morning, first off, to you, Paul. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be with you, Todd, and your listeners. Wonderful day here, and it's fun to ride my bike up and be on the air with you this morning.
Indeed it is. Paul McNamara is an associate professor. He's with U of I Extension, and he's a health and consumer economist. So, Paul, to begin with, let's have a broad-based question to talk and set the tone for our discussion over the next hour or so, which is simply, why is it interesting to discuss healthcare and access in rural America?
It's a great question. Rural healthcare is still on the agenda. It's still part of the national debate. Right now, we're in a national debate over access to care. Rural healthcare is interesting because of a couple reasons. One, there's enormous variation across rural areas, but there are significant differences between rural areas in the United States and metropolitan areas. And that's fleshed out in statistics that are easily available. And so so we see differences. Rural populations tend to be older on average. On average, they tend to have less education than people in metropolitan areas. Often we see a demographic phenomenon of rural kids, when they get to their 18s or early 20s, move out often to get education or go to bigger job markets, like, for instance, the Chicago area and in this state. And then we see some move back when people are older, maybe in their 40s or 50s, often to raise a family or enjoy a more rural lifestyle. And so there's some demographic differences. And there's some socioeconomic differences, too, tend to have pockets of poverty in areas, and then geographically, the access to care just in the level of technology, the level of services is lower in rural areas. So there's a couple reasons. And historically, rural health care has always been a part of both farm and rural policy debates and also health care debates in this country, going back a long time, even to, you can see it in the records of discussions about farm bills in the 40s, access to health care in the 30s. These were big issues for farm folks and rural people at that time, and they still are today.
And what are the biggest problems that rural Americans face when they look at access? Is it access to specialists? Is it emergency care access? Is it the availability of hospitals? Is it simply that they live so far away from available care? What are the types of issues that they must deal with?
Well, there's a lot of variation here. Some communities are in pretty good shape with good access to excellent primary care and a well-functioning emergency medical system, and because of a good, vibrant local hospital and clinic, they have access to visiting specialists and then referral networks. So some communities have that at the community level, but within those communities, even communities with a quite good, robust primary care system, you'll find some people that are falling through the cracks because of poverty or other issues. So there's issues with access to specialists. Take, for instance, the issue of children with significant behavioral health issues. And we know in downstate Illinois, when you go below sort of a line from Champaign over to Springfield, there are very few psychiatrists that are working with children. There have been some efforts recently to address that issue, but for a long time, that was a significant gap. And so families that had a kid, a child that was suffering these kind of issues from southern Illinois, say, from Harrisburg or that part of the state, they're going to get on a waiting list to see a specialist in St. Louis or Evansville, Indiana, or get up to Springfield. So there are those kinds of issues. And also, just because the healthcare systems are much smaller, they just don't have the heft and the breadth of specialties that are available on a everyday sort of basis. And so so that leads to travel times for people to see specialists and longer distances. In emergency care, another issue is a lot of rural emergency systems have relied on volunteers. This has changed more recently and is changing right now in the state. But that those networks are suffering a bit because of the pressure on people to take part in those. And it seems like some younger people are less interested in being a part of that system than previous generations. So there are a bunch of different things that come out as some of the access challenges we're facing. And then rural people, like people everywhere, face access challenges because of lack of health insurance for many people, or they may have health insurance, but oftentimes it's not in an actuarial sense. It doesn't cover as much. They may be at significant financial risk. And then for poor people, sometimes with Medicaid insurance, sometimes it's difficult to get to a provider who will see them.
Paul, you're an economist. Can you lay out the economics of a rural health care system for me in a community that does well and maybe one that doesn't do so well and what difference it makes?
Well, we have some communities around here. I think the anchor of a well-functioning rural health care system at this time is going to be a small rural hospital that is financially stable, has a group of committed physicians and other staff, the nursing staff, and has got that workforce side of it taken care of pretty well. So you've got a hub of a system with the hospital, often an affiliated clinic practice. And the stage, that stage has been set for by some changes over the past 10 to 15 years with the Medicare program carving out a portion of reimbursement for rural hospitals, the critical access program. So that's sort of the bedrock of a well-functioning system. You've got a viable practice and hospital, and then you're going to see some allied services around that with emergency medicine, clinic that has a good stream of specialists in different areas coming to deal with different chronic conditions, and then hopefully some access to behavioral health care services or services in the mental health area that are nearby that people are comfortable with and confident about, and then a public health program that's supported at the local level and deals with public health issues, public health planning, and gets things. I think those are some of the main things. And you can diagnose it by going to a community and talking with people and assess and see what their kind of issues people raise, the percentage of people that are comfortable getting their care locally versus traveling to a larger locale to get care. Those are some of the indicators. Talking with poor people, asking them if they're comfortable getting their services there, if they feel any stigma and are treated well in their healthcare system, how their access to care is. Those are some ways to assess how a healthcare system is doing.
We're talking this morning with Paul McNamara. He's a professor, associate professor in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences, specializing in agricultural economics and rural health issues. And if you'd like to join our conversation this morning, you can do that by calling this number. The local number is 217-333-9455. That's 333-9455, or you can call in on the toll-free line at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We do have a listener on that line. It's line 4. Joins us now. Do you have a question, and where are you calling from this morning?
Yes, hi. I'm calling on a cell phone from Rankin, Illinois. Just a couple of quick points and for your guests, and I'll listen offline. We live in a small eastern Illinois town, about 6,000 people. I would say probably, like most of the little communities around here, economically devastated with the happenings over the last few years. Lost some major industry. Anyway, going back to the hospital, it's a small 23-bed hospital. And at one point, we were involved with doing some fundraising. We found a film going back to the early 60s on the building of the hospital, and we were surprised to see that they actually had a clinic for newborns. Obviously, they don't do that anymore. Most of the hospitals, rural hospitals, are set up as almost a triage situation where they can be helicoptered, well, at this point, probably to Champaign. But I was just wondering, from your guest point of view, certain services like newborns and stuff, was that eliminated? Was that strictly driven by cost going way back when to the situation today? And then from a lobbyist point of view, small rural hospitals, do they have some sort of an association that can lobby for them to the Department of Public Health for the state? And I'll go ahead and listen offline. Thanks.
Okay, Paul. Okay. Two questions there.
Wonderful questions. First, about births and those services, we've seen nationally, this is not just in one community in Illinois, but we've seen nationally, and I think for good economic reasons, a shift of births away from small rural hospitals. Some of it is on the workforce side. Just getting the physicians that are willing to do this as part of their practice and cover the call schedule necessary to provide that service and be there all the time to handle births and all the potential complications that can happen around births. So part of it is the economics and the workforce issues that we've seen a shift away from births in rural hospitals. And by the way, in the past, say 15, 20 years ago, births were a good 10% of all hospital admissions for rural hospitals, and that has declined quite a bit since then, as this caller has talked about in the hospital he's referring to. So we've seen a shift away. I think a big part of it is due to the economics. Part of the economics, of course, is the risk of having a bad outcome in a birth situation and the hospital wanting to make sure that it can provide the necessary standard of care even in case something, an adverse outcome happened. Some hospitals are doing births and they're making the backup arrangements around call schedules so that there is sufficient coverage and all of those services are there. And so some hospitals still have it, but you need a significant dedication in terms of the physician staff in order to do that. Now, the other question had to do with what kind of, in terms of rural hospitals and rural health groups working together, there's a couple things here in Illinois that people should be aware of. First off, there's the Illinois Rural Health Association. I've been involved in that for about 10 years and been on the board along with a number of other people from East Central Illinois involved in that. And so that's a group that's a membership association. A lot of small hospitals are organizational members of it, and that does lobbying as well as educational programs and a research dimension to it, some promotion of rural health workforce development, a number of different issues, the Illinois Rural Health Association. So that's one place. And I would encourage rural people, especially community leaders, to please get involved if you're interested in ensuring the viability of your locally provided health care. It's locally provided health care is an important dimension of quality of life, as you know, but it's also an important part of the economic fabric and the overall community feel for a small community. Even a small town with 10 or 15,000 people, to have that present is an enormous contribution to their quality of life. So I'd encourage community leaders to look into that. There's also another group for hospitals, and all the hospital leadership are well aware of this. The Illinois Critical Access Hospital Network, ICANN, is another group. Pat Scow is the director, and that's a wonderful group in terms of bringing together rural hospitals, providing a set of services for those hospitals, including programs around distance education for their providers and continuing education programs, other services and assistance for rural hospitals. So those are two of the ones that are most active on rural health issues and rural hospital issues here in Illinois.
Again, listeners, if you'd like to join our conversation, you can do that this morning. The number to call locally is 333-9455. That is a 217 area code. And if you are out of that area code or you want to have a long-distance call and avoid the tolls, you can call us at 800-222-9455. That's 222-9455. Please join our conversation this morning with Paul McNamara. Paul, you mentioned the Illinois Rural Health Association. You sat on that board. It's a lobby organization. What do they lobby for?
Well, it has, as I mentioned, a number of different parts of its program. I think the best way to summarize its mission is about improving access to care in rural Illinois. As part of that is advocating on different healthcare issues. It also has an educational program. It has worked on things like workforce development, partnering with local issues for a long time here in this area. The IRHA partnered with Carl, the hospital in the Rural Health Center at Carl, to provide some summer camp opportunities for young people in East Central Illinois that were interested in learning about health careers and health career camps. And so it's had those kind of programs, the IRHA has. It in the past, every year has had a public policy kind of emphasis. Payment issues here at the state level has been a big issue for the past several years, where the state has been late in paying and reimbursing for Medicaid services to many of the providers, and the association has been active in lobbying, along with the primary association for the hospitals is the Illinois Hospital Association, but the Rural Health Association has worked to get people addressing that issue too. So it has a varied program of education, public policy events, an annual conference, some research, and some advocacy work.
Let's talk about the state's financial health and how that has had an impact on rural Americans and on the rural health care system. I was into the dentist office recently, and there was a sign that said if you had state of Illinois insurance, you needed to pay up front because they weren't being reimbursed quickly enough. I suspect that might be the case in the rural health care system in Illinois. Anyway, what kind of impact is it having?
So we've seen over the past few years a number of cases of clinics and practices that have really struggled because of delayed reimbursements from the state of Illinois. In one clinic in southeastern Illinois, the physician that owned the clinic had dug deep into his own savings to meet payrolls, and there was a situation where he had gone so deep into his own pocket in debt that it wasn't clear that the practice was going to be viable. I think other clinics have faced this issue if they have a large portion of Medicaid patients. I think what overall that does is makes providers less interested in working with those patients. And so patients that sort of spend down into Medicaid, they may have a medical home, but patients that don't have a medical home but present themselves at a clinic that's not a federally qualified health clinic, they have had difficulties in accessing care in a lot of communities in Illinois. And I think some of the callers could probably elaborate about this. But so that payment issue is a concern. It's also a concern going forward because this state faces a significant financial challenge going forward. And Medicaid is a big part of the financial challenge, along with some other parts, the weak pension systems and some other things. But the Medicaid system is a big part of the state's fiscal situation going forward. And it's not clear how the state is going to do it at paying its bills going forward and how the Medicaid program it's going to function.
Let's take another call on the toll-free line again on line 4. Where are you calling from this morning?
Bartlett,
and Illinois. Your question is?
Well, I got a couple of them. One, it would be, I know Obama wants to change all the formatting as far as this healthcare system is concerned. And I did at one time grow up in an area where there was rural. It was very small hospitals. But what I see happening is that he's taken all this stuff. What I'm afraid of is losing doctors to these smaller hospitals because they're going to go where the hospitals, the bigger ones, where the money is. I don't know if that's, a scenario that you think is coming up. But, I have health insurance, and I pay through the nose for it. Now, do I think it's right? No. But do I want to give it to somebody else? No, because I earn it. They don't. And I have a problem with that. I don't know. You think I'm being too selfish about that or what?
Well, Paul.
Okay, well, that's a good question. A couple questions I heard there. One was from what's on the table and what's being discussed in terms of federal health care reform, and a number of things, frankly, are in play. So we're not sure where we're going to end up, if anywhere, at this point in time. But the first question was, are we likely to see some change that's going to affect the ability of rural hospitals to attract and retain their physician staff? And I think that's not going to be the case. I think the critical access hospital program and the way that financing's been done under there is not going to change. And it shouldn't change the kind of scope of practice and some of the pluses that rural doctors like about their practice, their autonomy and scope of practice. It shouldn't change that so much, especially differentially to more metropolitan area practice, enough to see an exodus. So I don't think we're going to see a big workforce shift. Now, the second question is basically, what's my opinion about broadening coverage? And I think this is just this is a personal kind of value question. I'm for increasing coverage. I'd like to see everyone covered with health insurance that means something in this country. And from my own experience of working in rural communities, especially talking with poor people in research projects, focus groups, and that kind of thing, I think for a country that has a per capita income of about $46,000 in 2007 and spends as much of that, 16%, on health care to not have everyone covered is amazing, but also a real lost opportunity for us. And it's, to me, an indication that we're not getting what we could out of our health care system. I understand the caller's reluctance to subsidize somebody else, but the caller needs to keep in mind that he may be subsidizing them already through our system and the way care happens late often for people who are uninsured, but they do receive services. So
that's what I agree with you on that. Now, I think everybody should be covered, but you go by individual basis. For I know for a fact a lot of people using the welfare system to their advantage, illegally. And the part of my problem is, I'm scraping by. I can't make money. I can't make money fast enough to pay these bills. And if you look on it, and I don't know what kind of money you make. I'm in construction industry, and it's went down the toilet. So I've lost everything that I've worked for, all my IRAs, and I'm sure everybody, I don't want to sound like a whiner, but the bottom line is, sooner or later, we have to quit giving everybody money. It's not just the healthcare system. It's everything. I mean, and I beg to differ with people who want to argue this. Most of my family, by the way, lives in Europe, and they hate the system over there. I don't know one person over there that loves it. Canada, same thing. I mean, so if we're going to do this picture-perfect world in the state, we have to sit down and iron out someone. I mean, I'm not saying that they don't deserve. There's people who get with illnesses that have problem that are a chronic illness, and I know the insurance companies limit themselves, and I think it's not right. But at the same time, I know other people that have a drug problem who are getting away, some of these drug rehab clinics, for instance, insurance pays for some of that stuff. I mean, I live next to a community hospital, which is struggling because, guess what, of all the welfare people coming in, taking the money and running, and we can't get quality doctors in there because they're not going to work for free.
Caller,
I mean, the whole thing's nothing but a can of words, but I'll get off and listen. Yeah, thank you, sir.
Can I ask you one more question, caller, before you leave? Oh, that's all right. We'll talk to him. We'll talk about some other issues here shortly.
Well,
but
he does bring
up one question. Obviously, he was in the construction industry, we're going to suppose here, and Bartlett is someplace, I think, if I've got that right, between Schaumburg and Elgin. So he's in the metropolitan area as opposed to the rural area. But he sounded to me as if he's probably paying his own premiums, which is something that many folks in rural America do, or small business folks do. And it's an expensive proposition.
It certainly is. A couple things in reaction to the caller's question and sentiments. First off, he talks about the cost. And I'd just like to point out that in terms of looking at costs, a lot of health economists are focusing their attention on the value. What do we get for what we spend? There's a lot of evidence that our primarily fee-for-service-based system, for instance, Medicare, and a lot of our private health insurance, isn't that efficient. It just doesn't generate as much economic value in terms of the health outcomes and the health benefits that it could. The point is, you could spend that amount of money if you were going to take 16% of our GDP. You could think of better ways to invest it in health and have much better population health. So that's a flip side to the expensive insurance that this individual is paying, and I'm familiar and I'll have an anecdote about this in a moment. The flip side to that is that we have a very expensive and in many dimensions inefficient system. I think it's well documented that our system overall is very good at specialized care, for instance, in cancers and things like that. The U.S. health system is the best in the world. I think that's there's evidence and it's documented. But in terms of some other population health indicators, we really lag behind other countries that spend much less and have much lower GDPs than our country. So that's part of the drive behind people that are thinking about how could we do this better? How could we spend 16% of our GDP in a more effective manner and improve population health outcomes? So the flip side to his expensive health insurance is a question about how could we do better with 16% of our GDP? How could we organize systems? And there are a number of very promising things, if we have time, we can go into. Second, an anecdote. He's in construction, and self-employed individuals that are entrepreneurs that are in the private self-purchased health insurance market face a lot of difficulties. A couple comments. One, the kind of policies they tend to be able to buy because they're not part of a large employer group tend to be actuarially less valuable, or for the money they're paying, they cover much less of the expected healthcare costs. So they're not the same quality as health insurance for people that are part of a large employer group.
Pay more, get less healthcare.
Right.
And less insured, I suppose.
And one thing that is on the table would be national market reform. We have variation state to state at the present time. One thing that is on the table is national market reform in the area of risk rating. And we may see community risk rating where age and health status wouldn't be a part of that. And that for many rural people, a lot of farmers that do buy their health insurance in the self or individual market, in the private market, they would, I think, benefit under a change along those lines.
All right. We have many callers on the line, so let's get to a few more of them. We have someone on line one calling in. Thank you for joining our conversation. Do you have a question for Paul McNamara this morning? Line one, please. Are you with us?
I'm not sure.
Yes, you are.
Okay. It didn't buzz, so I didn't know.
That's okay.
Yes. A couple of points. I have several dozens or maybe hundreds of friends in Canada. A couple of them are doctors, and there are some college professors and just people. I have never met one of them that didn't like his health care system. And the stories that go around here in this country just don't seem to be happening in Canada. Secondly, I was visiting my wife's relatives in Europe this summer, Sweden and Denmark. And I had some discussions about health care. They like their system, and they can't understand what we're doing over here. Of course, they can't understand what we're doing over here in a number of areas, but that is the one that is pertinent at the moment.
Did they tell you why they liked it?
Yes, because they get care when they need it, and it doesn't come out of their pocket if it's a huge sum. They get the care very quickly, and they know they're going to get it, and it's good care. And I might point out that they didn't say this, but I know their life expectancy is several years longer than ours. Now, they don't seem to be as obese as we are either. On the other hand, they seem to do more smoking than we do.
Yeah.
Maybe that balances out.
Possibly.
A point about the fellow who was calling in, who was a frequent caller. He usually delivers a rant of this sort. He seems to have had infinite experiences in all areas of the world, and I question whether he has. But then I'm in no position to say he doesn't.
Right. Let's avoid that topic altogether, if that's okay.
Thanks.
I just thank you very much. Did you actually have a question or just those two comments?
I had those two comments because of his comments.
That's perfectly fine. Thank you very much for calling in, and I appreciate you doing that.
Very good. I don't have too much of a reaction. Right. I think they've kind of laid out the polar opposites on the sort of opinion spectrum about where we could go. And the rural angle to it, I guess, that I see is that some rural people may benefit quite a bit if we can shore up ways, especially for adults, non-elderly adults, to have better access to insurance coverage, especially because we have a significant number of rural people that are self-employed and in the farm occupations and other small businesses, and those folks may benefit. So that's sort of the rural twist on it. I don't see a big issue from what I understand about being proposed for rural hospitals and the physician angle that the first caller brought up.
If you'd like to join our conversation, again, the number to call is 333-9455. That's in the 217 area code. If it's a long-distance call, you can use our dime. The 800 number is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller on line two this morning. Good afternoon, or rather good morning to you. Line number two, where are you calling from today?
Muhammad.
Well, and your question for Paul McNamara is?
Well, I have sort of a comment. And
okay.
I think we're all just shrugging our shoulders and rolling our eyes about all the rhetoric on TV about how this is going to be socialism. If we change it, it'll be socialism. And it's just insane. It seems like the people don't have anybody representing them. And the rich people don't want to pay. And they can hire the lobbyists to stop politicians from voting for the people and instead have the politicians in the rich people's pockets. So I don't know what the solution is, but is there an organization that's actually fighting for the people in this lobbyist thing? And I'll just listen off line. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your call. Well, Paul, I suspect that's a tough one to answer and probably depends on your persuasion more than anything else.
It's a great question. I guess the takeaway I get from that question is how can we understand this debate? I think, as everyone knows, every industry group, every medical association is incredibly mobilized right now involved in the national discussion as much as they can to influence it. the insurance industry, the physicians, the hospitals, the employers, in different breakdowns of that, in Chamber of Commerce. All these groups at the national level are very active in trying to influence the agenda. And so it's an enormous amount of noise. I guess in defense of the politicians, a couple things. This is an incredibly complex area. It does cost money to cover people with health insurance. And so there are things that are proposed that would save money. But in terms of the regulations for how the Congressional Budget Office does the scoring, it's difficult to assess exactly how much savings might come out of some of these proposed things, like the insurance exchange, like some new things in evidence-based medicine. So that's why in the current bill that Baucus's committee has put forward, the outline of the bill, we see things like a lot of experimentation, a lot of pilot programs, in part to get over that hurdle about how do we reform a health system that really was built for 1950s and 60s kind of medicine, and yet we have medicine in the 21st century. So it's we have the infrastructure for a healthcare system that has payment systems designed for a very different kind of healthcare, and so that's why we have this push. So I think the caller, the confusion and sort of frustration with the rhetoric, is very widely shared. But there, on the other side, there are these incredible gaps in coverage, and the cost thing, we are all paying for that in one way or another, in either foregone wages that are being put into as companies and organizations put any additional income into health insurance premiums. Those are foregone wages, basically, that workers don't realize. And for self-employed people, they're premiums. So that's the push. And we're going to be dealing with this one way or another for a while.
I do recall I was vacationing during the summertime, and I was in Arizona and heard a commercial from Walmart talking about reform, and they were suggesting that they wanted the reform that the president was pushing at that time. It surprised me that Walmart was involved in that process. I don't know that we need to talk about that any more than that, but it's just interesting that there is a lot of discussion about this topic, and I suppose she's really wanting to know if there's some place that she might be able to get to that would lay it out in easy to understand terms. Is that possible?
The place I go to is health affairs and publications like that that are more popular. They're still for policy analysts, but they're written in a popular style. They have experts from a variety of different sort of political persuasions that weigh in. Health affairs, it's a magazine.
It's a magazine. Is it online as well?
I'll look it up
while we have our discussion, and maybe I can get that website out if I can find it. Another question. We talked a little bit about technology and how that is changing rural health care and how the system's not actually quite built for that.
Yeah.
At least the payment system isn't.
Right.
But maybe you could talk about the advances in technology, telemedicine, and how it's changing rural health care.
So we're seeing a lot of, and this is a very exciting area for, take for instance, chronic care for things like diabetes and other chronic conditions that need monitoring and communication between a patient and maybe a nurse team or a nurse that's responsible for a person in their case. And so in an area like chronic care, new technologies that can facilitate the link between patient monitoring and communication with a provider, these kinds of things have a lot of promise to improve patient care. Coming up with payment systems, though, that can reimburse because there's not a visit involved there, these kinds of things we haven't gotten so far along there. Another area would be take the behavioral health or mental health area that I mentioned earlier. telemedicine consultations. Those are an issue where in a lot of rural communities, if you could set up a link with a provider, mental health, say a psychiatrist, you may be able to improve the quality of care for that rural resident. And so that's another way that telemedicine can work. And right now we have a lot of things going on with communication on emergency medicine between smaller hospitals and larger hospitals, diagnostics, all those kinds of things. One of the things that where we the policy kind of isn't keeping up with the technology is in the area of reimbursement, reimbursement across state lines. Providers that might be, say, in Illinois or Chicago, can they provide that service across state lines for a small hospital in Indiana? Those kinds of things haven't been all sorted out yet. So the payment systems haven't caught up with the promise of some of the newest technologies.
We have just about 10 minutes left as we continue our conversation on rural health care and access. Paul McNamara is our guest in studio on this first hour of Focus 580. If you'd like to join that conversation, the number is 333-9455 locally, 800-222-9455. I did take a look at that publication you discussed earlier, Paul, and the website is Health Affairs. All one word, .org or .org. That's healthaffairs.org. We have somebody on line one that would like to join our conversation this morning. Good morning to you. Where are you calling from today? Line one? Just joined our conversation. Are you there?
Yes.
Ah, good morning. And you have a question for Professor McNamara?
I had a comment that's just very practical that I think kind of points out for people what the problem is, why our health care is so expensive. One needs only to spend one evening in their local emergency room to see where health care costs are going. We have people who come in. I'm a nurse and have worked in the emergency room. People come into the emergency room by ambulance because they have no car fare. They come into the ambulance when they have a sore throat because they have no way to see a doctor. The clinics won't accept them without insurance. And so those hospital, those ER visits are over $1,000. The ambulance ride, not sure how much that costs. But the insurance, I mean, the hospital has to get paid some way, so they charge other people who have insurance higher premiums to help pay for all those people who are coming in through the emergency room. So if people had their own insurance, say they had high blood pressure, they could be taking high blood pressure antihypertensive medication for years and avoid a stroke. Without that medication, they'll come into the emergency room with a stroke, all kinds of expensive care, CT scans, hospitalizations, rehab. So I just wanted to point out to people that think that they're paying high premiums for insurance, that they're paying for other people. Yes, they are, but if everyone had insurance, then it wouldn't cost us all so much because people could use doctor's offices and clinics instead of coming into the emergency room. That's all I had to say.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, Paul, she suggests that preventative health care is good maintenance. Is there proof that that's the case?
Yeah, and she also points out the issue of cost shifting that we do see in our system right now. I guess my reading of the literature regarding cost shifting is that it explains part of the cost that we see, but it really doesn't explain the growth in costs that we've seen over time. And so it may be a fraction of it, but broader things are driving the growth in healthcare costs, which we're seeing in our higher insurance premiums over time.
Have we been able to identify those things?
And some of the things that are behind that, some are demographic and structure of population, those kinds of things. But some of them have to do a lot more with medical technology. We have access to so much more healthcare than we did, say, 30 years ago in terms of the procedures that you could have access to, the level of testing that you can have access to. So the pharmaceutical products that you can have access to, just sort of the level and quality of healthcare that is out there now is so much greater than before. So technology is a big part of that. Another part is just the structure of how we pay. We still have very much a fee-for-service-based system, and that has incentives for providers to do tests, not always the most evidence-based tests or procedures, and it has incentives for encounters, but not always incentives for population or group of patient health. And so there are some areas there on the cost side where she talks about prevention. I agree with her, but there are some things in prevention interventions in the area of weight management, improved diet, immunizations. Even as she points out, having a regular medical home would reduce the likelihood of someone going to the ER, but it also would reduce the likelihood for anyone of being hospitalized, someone with a chronic condition, if they have a good medical home, and if that medical home, the providers there, have an incentive to help that patient really manage their condition, say someone with diabetes, someone with another chronic condition, they can reduce the severity of illness. This is documented in the health services research literature. Also, we can save costs with more evidence-based treatment guidelines and protocols to reduce errors. There are groups right now in Minnesota. There's a regional health improvement collaborative that works with a whole set of employers, healthcare providers. They're sharing data. They're working on clinical improvement with evidence and information, sharing that across so that buyers, large employers that spend a lot of money on health insurance, can tell what are they getting for in terms of health outcomes, quality of care, those kinds of things. And I think we need more of that. We need to bring some of the information and management technologies that we have in other industries into healthcare and do it more and more.
We have three calls online, so we'll do very short answers. I have a question before we get to them based on, and this I think will be a very short answer. You suggest that the technology has driven some of the cost. You would think that that should go down over time as more of it is adopted more widely. Is it experimental technology that drives the cost?
I guess, Todd, what I'm saying is that technology has driven costs because we have access to fundamentally new health interventions, health products, health drugs that weren't even around, weren't even thought of 30 or 40 years ago.
It's additional
we have
healthcare
brand new
things, not,
things out
right,
there.
Right, right.
In fact, like if you look at something like how a heart attack is dealt with 40 years ago, completely different than now. The outcomes are way better now. Cancer, the same thing, but it costs a lot more.
Right.
And so it's technology. We're getting something for it. But technology does explain a large part of our healthcare cost.
So it's the additive effect. Instead of having one option, there are five options, and you might use three of them to take care of the problem.
And, some of them are way better than anything we had before.
Correct. Okay, so line four, which is the toll-free line, you have a question for Paul. Line four on the 800 number. Are you with us today?
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I thought it was line one.
That's all right.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, part of Medicare with their reimbursement, they effectively like set prices, kind of across the states, so that doctors get paid the same regardless of what state they work in and what rural or otherwise area that they work in. Like so, for injections of some kind.
Right.
Is that true? Would the new healthcare system keep with that, or in trying to try to make it more fair and level playing field or whatever their modus operandi is here. But would they try to reevaluate that so that in rural areas they would make medicine cheaper because doctors don't have the same overhead in terms of like the rent that they pay or the lease that they pay or you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
right.
Here's
my question. Sorry, I had to rush that because I know you guys.
Right, that's okay.
Thank you very much.
So there is differential reimbursement, especially on the hospital side. Based on a pretty complicated Medicare formula. And when I was talking about the Critical Access Hospital Program, that's kind of taken that small set of hospitals, that small portion of Medicare's budget, out of that game altogether and reimburse on the basis of costs. But for other people, other hospitals, payments do vary by geography, by area. And that's been part of the debate, is the system that's used actually reflecting real costs and not historical costs? There's enormous variations that are associated with the payments, but also in procedures done across areas and a lot of things.
Line number two joins us now with a question. Your question from line two?
Yes, I just have a comment. You know, when they come up with these Europeans that hate their health care system, you've got to remember that they have the luxury. They've had that health care system a long time, so they take it for granted, just like we take good things out of our government for granted. So if you told them tomorrow that now all of a sudden they have to buy their health insurance, and by the way, pre-existing's not covered. If you got arthritis, they won't pay for health, hip replacement. I tell you, I can assure you, they would riot. They would not go for it. They'd love their health care system then. But also, you also have to pay attention to how they word things. Like, for instance, they have this commercial where they have this British girl crying and saying that if only she had a pap smear, she wouldn't be dying of cancer. But she doesn't say she wasn't offered a pap smear. I'll tell you, I was in Europe 7 years, and every year I had my pap smear done in England for free. I'm an American citizen. They just did it.
All right, thank you very much. And we have a caller on line one. We'll get that last question in if we can. Line number one.
Tuned in late. Maybe you covered this, but the federal government is insolvent, headed for bankruptcy. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid are all deeply in debt. What makes them think they can run a financially viable, effective program?
All right. Thank you very much. To line one, I guess we can end on that one, and you've got maybe 30 seconds to wrap it up.
Well, I guess the theme today has been rural. You know, we kind of get into the healthcare reform issue, and I do think there's some distinct rural angles to the healthcare reform issue. For some parts of the rural population, especially those in the self-employed market, they just are going to benefit. So thanks,
Todd.
It's been great being on with you.
We're all done for the day. Paul McNamara is with us. He's an associate professor in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. We've been talking about rural health care. This is the First Hour Focus 580. I'm Todd Gleason.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe, offering lunches from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, and an early afternoon after hour from 1 to 3 p.m. featuring soups, sandwiches, salads, pastries, and specialty coffees. Bevere Cafe is student-operated in Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana. Support comes from the Westchester Group, specializing in land auctions for farmland, timberland, and recreational land. More information on upcoming auctions is available online at westchester-auctions.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade. Prices are showing a softer tone today as all of the frost news that we had seen earlier in the week has primarily dissipated from the short-term and middle-range forecasts. Soybeans, though, holding above its 200-day moving average, trying to make a stand at that particular point. Let's go ahead and look at some particulars.